listening to Tavis Smiley, and I'm glad about it. We are now in our second hour of today's program, and the first hour was insightful in a variety of ways. I look forward to some more insights in this hour, now that we are joined by the former Homeland Security Secretary during the Obama era, Jay Johnson, who is back with us to offer his assessment, I hope, of all current threats, both foreign and domestic. Secretary Johnson, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Tavis. Thank you for having me back on your show. I appreciate the Edwin Starr lead-in. And I also appreciated your reference to what happened in baseball history 50 years ago yesterday. Growing up, I was an avid Hank Aaron fan. I followed literally every at-bat in the 1972-73 season. And I know you're a student of history. Mm-hmm. You recall that he tied the record, the season opener on April 4th, 1974, mm-hmm. at Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati, pitch-off Jack Billingham. And Henry, being the man he was, I remember this, he called out the Cincinnati Reds that day. Even though it was a lot to celebrate, he called them out for failing to acknowledge that that day was the sixth anniversary of Dr. King's assassination.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of man Henry Aaron was.
No, he was an amazing man, not just a great player. I've said many times he was a more an amazing person than he was even a great player. I get goosebumps at times. I've said this, you know, countless times, I suspect, in the course of my career, particularly as these persons transition and from us. But I feel humbled and grateful every day when I think about all the persons who I've had a chance to converse with, to interview in public and in private conversations, to learn more about their backstory, to call some of them friends. There are any number of photos I have in my office of Hank Aaron, Henry Aaron, and yours truly. And in one of these photos, which is probably my favorite, somebody captured me sitting next to Hank Aaron one day. And you can just look at my eyes and the way I am staring at Hank Aaron. At that point, I knew him already. I'd spent time with him, had gotten to know him. We were in Atlanta for an event together. He lived in Atlanta, of course. I was there for an event with him. He's looking off into the distance, but I am staring at him as a grown man, as a grown man, like I would have had I met him as a kid, because he was one of my he was one of my heroes. And so this picture is an amazing photo of me just staring at Hank Aaron as I'm sitting right next to him. And then in this building, of course, this program is syndicated across the country, heard in markets everywhere. But I'm based in L.A., as I often say. I'm pleased to be at my home station of KBLA here in Los Angeles. But in this building that I've owned for 20-some years, where this studio is housed, when we did the deal for the station, we moved it into my building to make it easy for me, because I'm too lazy. I didn't want to drive across town. I want to walk down the hallway. So we moved the station into my building so I could literally walk down the hallway to in my studio every day. But down the hall from me, where I sit right now, in another room, I had a mural years ago, had a mural painted inside my building of my favorite athletes. My favorite athletes are on that mural.
Yes.
And Hank Aaron is on the mural of my favorite athletes. There's Julius Erving. There's Hank Aaron. There's, of course, Muhammad Ali. There is Wilma Rudolph. There's Arthur Ashe. These are there's Magic Johnson. There are just a handful of some of my favorite athletes. But Hank Aaron was an amazing guy. And to your point, we just celebrated. I keep saying celebrated. I celebrated his life and legacy, but we commemorated the 56th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination just days ago. So, so for you to tell this story about Hank Aaron tying the record on April 4, and at that moment it was the sixth anniversary of his assassination. Here we are now, talking to on this program, and we're commemorating the 56th anniversary of
that's
his assassination.
Correct.
That's
correct.
That gives me goosebumps, Secretary Johnson. Gives me goosebumps.
Well, if you'll allow me one more
Hank Aaron
story.
Sure.
growing up, he was my idol. I was 16 years old when he broke the record. I loved playing baseball. I fashioned myself a future Major League Baseball player, though I could never hit a curveball, and I didn't have the throwing arm, so it wasn't going to happen. But the thing that I admired about Henry Aaron was he was a strong, dignified, low-key, no-drama black man. Mm-hmm. He just went and did his job every day. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, he passed Willie in the home run race for the all-time record. And everybody looked up and said, hey, who's this guy, Henry Aaron? And he's been, you know, consistently hitting 40, 44 home runs a year. And all of a sudden, everybody notices him because he was no drama. He just went after went out there and hit the ball day after day. A couple years later, I was a freshman at Morehouse College. This would probably have been 1975, 76. He had been traded to Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And it was the off season, and I was out on the street in Atlanta watching the homecoming parade. And I just happened to glance at the other people on the street watching the homecoming parade in the neighborhood in southwest Atlanta. And I look up, and there is Henry Aaron, mm-hmm. standing there all by himself in his dungarees. Nobody is talking to him. Nobody is noticing him. He blended right in, and he didn't need the recognition. Yeah. And he was just a low-key, dignified black man who didn't need the didn't need autographs, didn't need photos. He was content to just blend right into that crowd in southwest Atlanta in 1975. Yeah. And I was so struck by that. He was my hero standing 10 feet away from me. Yeah. So, anyway.
For those listening across the country, the reason why we got into this conversation is that we were playing some news here locally in Los Angeles about a statue that they are unveiling in Cooperstown, the Baseball Hall of Fame, honoring Hank Aaron all these decades after his breaking the record set by Babe Ruth. And so Secretary Johnson heard that news bit about this ceremony forthcoming and commented on that, and that's how we got into a tribute to Hank Aaron. Didn't know we were going to go there, but I never know where this show is going to go. That's why I just love just being organic, being in the moment, and following my guest as I do every hour. I'll continue to follow Secretary Johnson when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
From the Merck Park with love, this is Tavis Smiley. Let's get back to more of Tavis Smiley right now.
More of former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson right now on Tavis Smiley. Secretary Johnson, I am a student of history, as are you, and I'm also a little nerdy. And so I was thinking during that break about April 4. You got me going now. You got me thinking about April 4. So that date is significant in black history for a lot of reasons. Michael Eric Dyson was our guest on this program, as I said, on April 4 this year when we commemorated the 56th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination in Memphis. So we know that King is assassinated on April 4. Here you come telling us today, reminding us today that Hank Aaron tied the record of Babe Ruth on April 4. And I hadn't thought about that until you said it. We know that April 4, as I mentioned on our program days ago, is the birth date of not just Maya Angelou, but also Muddy Waters. Both of these American icons are born on April 4. We know that, and I hadn't really thought about this, Michael Dyson, who's a fan of Beyonce and Jay-Z, and while he was on the program the other day, we were talking about Beyonce's Cowboy Carter album, since you're a music lover. So Beyonce and Jay-Z were married on April 4. So
that one I did not know.
I hadn't thought about that either until Dyson said it. So my point is that there's a whole lot of black history connected to that date of April 4. And so, again, that's the nerd in me. You got me thinking about April 4. So now I'm jotting down all the things I can recall about what happened on April 4. So anyway, I digress on that. But I'm glad you made me think about April 4 and all the black history that we celebrate. As we commemorate, again, the life and legacy of Dr. King, but there's a lot of stuff to celebrate about that day. And so I thank you for kind of making me think about that. All right, let me move forward. There's a lot I want to cover with you in the hour that we have. And I'm glad we had that moment of just sort of that moment of black joy, if I can put it that way, that black joy moment, because now I want to get a little less joyful, if I can put it that way, in the rest of this conversation, because there's a lot of news to talk about. And you don't talk to the former Secretary of Homeland Security and think the conversation is going to be a bed of roses. So,
correct.
Yeah, so let's talk about some tough stuff. Let me just ask you a broad question, and again, I will follow you. When you have been the Secretary of Homeland Security. And you see, and you're watching in the news every day, paying attention as you do to all the news that we're following here. On a day like today, you have Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, saying that there's no evidence. The U.S. sees no evidence at this point of genocide on the part of Israel in Gaza. Those are his comments today, and everybody's talking about that. Bibi Netanyahu says today that they are going into Rafah anyway, never mind the protestations of many. They're going into Rafah anyway. The U.S. continues to arm Israel. And I'm not trying to make you political. What I'm driving toward here is when you have been as a black man, Morehouse educated, the former Secretary of Homeland Security, and you see all of these things happening, does it put you on, pardon the phrase here, high alert for any blowback that we might get domestically because of the way we are playing this game internationally, if that makes sense at all?
The simple answer, Tavis, is yes. I have to believe that since October 7th, our Homeland Security forces and personnel have been on heightened alert as a result of what's happening. The attack on October 7th and the aftermath, the manner, frankly, in which the IDF has conducted its counterterrorism operations in Gaza has turned the world upside down politically. And it has reverberated everywhere. It's reverberated here in New York City. It's reverberated on the campus of Columbia University. It reverberates in just about every political rally you might attend across the United States. And so, and I want to come back to Secretary Austin's point about genocide. I happened to see him at the Pentagon just last week. Mm-hmm. But in October, I think it was maybe a week, maybe 10 days after October 7, I gave a speech at UC Irvine, out where you are. Mm-hmm. And I said that, of course, I deplored the terrorist attack, but said Hamas, this is 10 days after the attack, Hamas is counting on Israel to overreact. And just the way they embed their people underneath hospitals in heavily crowded areas, they were counting on Israel to overreact. And I pointed out that my hope that there are some lessons the IDF, the State of Israel, will learn from our reaction to 9/11. Of course, we live with Abu Ghraib. We live with the excesses there and in a host of other places. The entire Iraq war, which was started on a false premise, mm-hmm. that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. But it was in the environment, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, that the political will existed to launch that war that we didn't have to launch. And I'm afraid that history is repeating itself on a massive scale and a very focused scale in Gaza. What is happening in Gaza is, I would not definitionally call it genocide. Genocide is the murder of a race of people because of their race. It's a calculated effort to try to exterminate, eliminate a people because of their race. There have been far, far too many atrocities in Gaza. The IDF has not conducted this operation well. We don't know that they're through yet. And the State of Israel has managed to turn many of its best friends against them, destabilize the entire Middle East, and even its best friend in that part of the world, the United States, is now having to publicly criticize their efforts. And I got to believe there are elements of Hamas that are quite pleased at this turn of events. Mm-hmm.
So if I hear you correctly, you agree with Secretary Austin's comments today that there is no evidence, the U.S. sees no evidence of genocide in Gaza. So, you, as I hear you, you agree with that assessment?
I wouldn't put it, I wouldn't put it that way. I would say there are mass atrocities. Mm-hmm. The death toll is staggering. The death toll among children is staggering. Innocent civilians, it's staggering. It does not meet strictly the legal definition of genocide. You can call it a whole lot of other things, mm-hmm. Tavis, but it does not neatly fit the definition of genocide.
You called it, you did in fact call it, though, as I heard you, an overreaction, correct?
Very much so, yes.
Okay. All right. Let me unpack that part then. You're entitled to your opinion. You're former Secretary of Homeland Security, so I have you on to express yourself, and you have.
If I could add, the former senior legal official of the Department of Defense.
Yeah, indeed. I'm glad you added that. So that makes it even makes the conversation even more prescient. Your comments, I should say. I may come back to the genocide thing. I want to noodle that just for a second. But let me come to this point you made about the overreaction. So given how close an ally Israel is to the U.S., so close, in fact, that while the president says one thing out of one side of his mouth, he does something else. And that is to say, and I'm not dogging Joe Biden, I'm just putting facts on the table. He has been pressing him. We keep getting these leaks. We keep getting these this commentary out of the White House. But yet we keep sending them weapons to engage and continue what you would call an overreaction. They're doing that with American weapons. So having said that part, given how close an ally Israel is to us, what do you make of the fact, to your brilliant point earlier, about the lessons that we should have learned from 9/11, that Israel did not learn those lessons watching us? We can't be that close with you not paying attention to what we did and how we screwed up. Why haven't they learned the lessons that we learned from what we did overreacting after 9/11?
Tavis, that's a good question. I cannot crawl into the mind of Prime Minister Netanyahu, nor am I in the Situation Room anymore. So I don't pretend to know all of the intelligence, all of the dynamics of what's going on. It is inexplicable to me. And unfortunately, we have to relearn lessons of history at least once or twice a generation. The United States itself has had to relearn some of the mistakes of our own history. You know, you go from Vietnam to Afghanistan to Iraq, and we fail to learn from our mistakes and the manner in which we conduct warfare. Gaza is unlike anything that the U.S. military has had to undertake. It's a densely populated urban area for the most part, and the terrorist organizations that Israel seeks to root out are deeply embedded in places like hospitals, apartments, residential space, underground, in tunnels. I would, however, like to believe, knowing them as I do, that if U.S. Special Forces had a similar mission to root out a terrorist organization intending to kill Americans, we would be able to do a more precise surgical job at this. And I want to read the final report or book on just why Israel has conducted itself the way it has in this operation. Yeah. It's losing world support, which has to matter a lot to them.
While we wait for that book to be written, innocent women and children are being killed every day. While that book is being written, so I take your point. Yeah, let me raise this issue. An issue that we raised in the last hour with our guest, Bhaskar Sankara, who is the president of The Nation magazine. I raised this with him, and I'm reprising it for a particular reason with you, Secretary Johnson. We talked in the last hour about what it means to have black faces in high places. As you well know, because you were one of those black faces in high places as Secretary of Homeland Security, there was a time in this country's history, rather, where black people weren't deemed worthy enough, intelligent enough, talented enough, adroit enough, brilliant enough to be making public policy decisions about foreign policy. Mentioned you mentioned having gone to Morehouse, so Dr. King comes up in this conversation once again. As you well know, being a student of history, they went after Dr. King, as I said last hour, for his Beyond Vietnam speech, where he called America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. They told him, and I quote, "Negro, stay in your lane. Stay in your lane." Foreign policy.
Frankly, some prominent African American.
Absolutely. They told him foreign policy is not your purview. I did do a tribute last hour to Ralph Bunche, who was one of those Negroes in high places years ago and did his part back in 1948, again, as you know. But in real time, there are a number of black faces in high places making these decisions, speaking publicly on behalf of our government. I'm thinking, of course, about Lloyd Austin, Department of Defense.
Yep.
I'm thinking about Linda Thomas Greenfield as U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. I'm thinking about even our Vice President, Kamala Harris. These are all black folk in high places. You mentioned 9/11, so I say all that to circle back to another black face in a high place, Colin Powell, who you knew well.
I knew you were going to go there. Yeah,
you knew I was going there, man. You're a mind reader.
I knew you were going there.
Yeah, so I got 2 minutes now. We can start this and continue when we come forward. But since you mentioned 9/11 and all the mistakes we made, there was one particular black man who I liked personally, who was at the epicenter of that huge mistake, that overreaction.
Made the case to
the U.S. He made the case. You got it. He made the case. So I've only got a minute and a half. We can start and continue when we come forward. But start to unpack for me in retrospect how you look at the way that, this is my word, it could be over, I could be overstating it, the way that Colin Powell was or allowed himself to be exploited in that moment.
Colin Powell was in that moment probably the most credible figure in the Bush administration. And they sent him to the UN to make the case. I remember listening to that speech on my television in my office, listening intently, thinking, now I'm going to finally hear the case from the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, for why we need to go into Iraq. And I remember the reaction I had. Is that it? That's all you've got? That's it? And, you know, the stories are that he rolled up his sleeves. He went to the CIA. He said, give me everything you have. And was, you know, not that impressed himself, but like the good soldier he was, he did what the president asked him to do, and I'm sure he probably regretted it toward the end of his life.
Talk more about that when we come forward. Colin Powell, again, as the blackface that had to convince this country and indeed the world why we were going to do what we did after 9/11, and it turned out to be done under false premises. As many have said, those so-called weapons of mass destruction became a weapon of mass distraction, and somebody's still looking for those WMDs. We never found them. But Colin Powell was used in that regard. I raise that only because there are black folk right now in real time who are being used to make this case, and I wonder if, like Colin Powell, near the end of their lives, they will regret the role they played in making a case. You take my point. More when we come forward with the former Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, on Tavis Smiley.
Unapologetically progressive. Unapologetically blind. Black. You're tapped into Tavis Smiley. Tavis Smiley. Smiley. He's rooting for everybody black. Everybody black. Black. More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now. Right now. Right now. Right now.
So I asked Miles, my board op, to ask Secretary Johnson what song he wanted to come back with. What you may not know, that I do know, some of you know this, Secretary Johnson is a music lover, and not just a music lover, but has his own music program. Yes, he was Secretary of Homeland Security, but he's a music lover. And again, host his own program. And so I asked him what song he wanted to come back with. I think I can guess why, but tell me why you chose this track, Secretary Johnson.
Well, I thought it was suitable given our conversation, and I very often open my own show on WBGO in Newark, New Jersey, with this very song. Wake up, everybody. And Saturday mornings, once a month, WBGO 88.3 FM in Newark, New Jersey. And I have a lot of fun with the show. I spend way too much time with my playlist, Tavis, trying to select my music. But I often lead off. I often open my show with this song.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a powerful track, and you can't do much better than Theodore Pendergrass.
That's right.
As the lead vocal on that thing. And so yeah, I'm sorry.
That's
go ahead.
Right.
Yeah, you gonna say something?
Coming back to the discussion of Colin Powell.
Sure.
He was a war hero, a statesman whose stature and credibility transcended race. I mean, he was not put out there in the UN because he was black. He was put out there because he was Colin Powell.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been very few black figures in American history whose stature transcended race, Barack Obama being the other example, obviously. And so you're correct that you see more and more black faces in high public office, in positions that, you know, we traditionally did not occupy, like Homeland Security or State or, you know, UN Ambassador. And I'd like to think that's progress.
Mm-hmm.
We're not confined to issues that you associate with black folks. So, you know, we're dealing with national security and all elements mm-hmm. of public service now.
Yep. I think you're right about your assessment that in some regards, I do want to push back respectfully. In some regards, I think you're right about the fact that Colin Powell, his position transcended race. Clearly, in some regards, President Obama's stature transcended race. I take your point. And yet, we can't deny the fact that they are still black. And I raise that because there's an old adage. That, again, you were Secretary of Homeland Security, so you're in this group as well, man. I ain't leaving you out of this group. You in this group as a black face in a high place. At the end of the day, you're still African American. And at the end of the day, that adage is still true, that when and where you enter, or where we enter, as black faces in high places, when and where we enter, the whole race enters with us. So you may be Secretary of Homeland Security, you may be Defense Secretary, you could be Vice President, you could be the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., you could be any of those positions. And yet, at the end of the day, because you are still black, we get judged differently. We get judged differently. And so when you're the one making the case for the U.S. in that black skin, there is a price oftentimes that black people writ large end up paying because of your missteps, because of your misstatements, because of your misdeeds, whatever they might be. And so I wonder whether or not you would consider that point of view, even though you argue that their race transcends.
You know who I think of? You got me really candid here, Davis. You know who I think of when you say all of that is Fannie Willis.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
No, it's
we
can't avoid that. We are just judged differently. We are painted with a broad brush. And the other thing is this: these high positions may allow you to transcend race in a certain way. But you certainly, again, student history, understand this. The world is full of people of color, and around the world, these people of color are watching people of color speaking for the U.S. making these statements. That's a big deal, Secretary Johnson.
People of color are a majority of the human race, aren't they?
Exactly. That's my point. People are watching people of color in this country, speaking for this country, saying and doing things that they find curious.
Yep. Yet, Tavis, I have to add this.
Sure.
And maybe you've explored this on your show. Maybe you have an answer for me. Yet, Donald Trump appears, if you believe the polls, to be doing better and better among black voters.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Yep.
You know, and the thing that galls me, he does not have to win the black vote this election. He just has to get enough of it to make a difference in certain swing states, like Michigan or Pennsylvania. For all of the demagoguery, for all of the Stephen Millers who populated his administration, he may get as much of the black vote as you have, as Richard Nixon going back to 1960.
Yeah.
I still don't understand that.
It is a conundrum to me as well, and yet because you posed it to me, I figure if I can ask tough questions of you, and you can answer them, yeah. If you pose a tough question to me, I'll do my best to answer it. So when we come forward, I'm going to do my best to attempt to answer the provocative question, the perplexing question that Secretary Johnson poses just now. How is that possible? How is it possible that Donald Trump, again, who doesn't have to win the black vote, how is it possible that he can siphon off a sizable or significant number of black votes, maybe as much or more than what Richard Nixon did years ago? Let me do my best to respond to that when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
This is getting good.
Yeah, man.
Tavis Smiley, Tavis Smiley continues when we come forward. More honesty than you can handle.
More empowerment than you can imagine.
You're tuned in to Tavis Smiley.
All right, Secretary Johnson, you put I thought you were my friend, man. That question is a pretty impossible question.
They just said your show is more honesty than you can handle, so there you go, Tavis.
Yeah, okay, well, yeah, you're hearing the promos. Now I gotta live up to that promo, more honesty than you can handle. Well, right. let me give you some honesty then, as I see it. And again, let me be very clear about two things. I do not speak for black folk. It ain't like they meet at my house every Sunday and give me the script for the week. That's not how this works. Number one, so I don't speak for black people writ large, number one. And number two, you and I clearly are simpatico on Donald Trump. I ain't got to even say that. We are absolutely lockstep on the lunacy of this Trump campaign and the man himself. That said, these are things I've heard routinely and consistently over this electoral season that may help you understand better the issue that you raised. One, in no particular order, it ties back to these black faces in high places we were just talking about. When you continue to see black faces in high places, but the imperialistic policy of this government vis-a-vis foreign policy does not change, that's a problem. We were just talking about that. You got all these black people in these high positions, but the policy of the U.S. government with regard to Israel specifically and other issues remains unchanged, then it starts to make you question the party in power. Because you got black people there, mm-hmm. but the policy ain't changing. That's number one. Number two, this administration, the Biden administration, I think has done an admirable job of stewarding the economy, 39 straight months of job growth. I can make the case better than they can. Trust me, they're not as good as I am in making their own case. I say that with no humility. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are things this administration failed to get done that do matter to a significant slice of black people. They failed to get meaningful voting rights legislation passed. They failed to get meaningful police reform passed. I'll stop there. There are other things they failed at, and there are reasons for that, but it has not been as progressive an administration as some would like. Number three, these disparities that exist between black folk and white folk in this country. We discussed this with economist William Darity out of Duke yesterday. Joe Biden advanced this notion in his recent State of the Union address that the gap between black and white wealth was at its lowest in history. Well, that's not really true, as we learned yesterday talking to Professor Darity on this program. So this stubbornness of these disparities make you wonder why you keep doing the same thing the same way. You know that adage, that insanity is doing the same thing the same way and expecting a different result. So if you keep voting for Democrats every year and the same stuff keeps happening, these numbers don't move, that makes some people question the efficacy of not just the system, but of voting for Democrats. And finally, and I'll shut up and let you respond when we come forward in our remaining minutes since you asked me this question. And this again, more honesty you can handle. You worked in the Obama administration, but it's just, I'm laying the facts out. The numbers are, the data is incontrovertible. Black people still lag far behind in every single leading economic indicator category, even after the Obama era. Now, I'm not naive. You don't fix all this in 8 years. I get that. But the reality is the reality that black folks still lag far behind in every single leading economic indicator category, even after 8 years of the first black president. Those are just four issues that I hear consistently in conversation with a variety of people about why people are just a little uneasy in this particular moment in American history. That's my answer. It's the best I can do. We'll let Secretary Johnson respond when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward. Helping to make you the most knowledgeable person in your circle of friends. This is Tavis Smiley.
Secretary Johnson, you asked me a tough question, and again, I don't speak for black people, and God knows Donald Trump is the last person I want to see back in the White House, but you asked a legitimate question, and I tried to give you some answers that I've been hearing, at least your thoughts.
I agree with everything you said. Plus, historically, the black vote in this country, ever since about 1964, has been a block vote that has voted Democratic, you know, 90%, 95%, mm-hmm. the most monolithic vote in American history. That was, as time progresses, as time passes, that was bound to change as you see more diversity of thought. And, you know, given our economic conditions, and, you know, when a black president was elected in 08, that did not end poverty, did not end black poverty, did not end segregation. It did not end police shootings of innocent black men.
Nope.
It, you know, takes more than one presidency to accomplish all of that, more than one attorney general, mm-hmm. more than one black secretary of DHS. But, you know, we've become susceptible to the message, what have you got to lose, mm-hmm. which is what Trump said in 2016. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my answer to that is, let's not be fooled.
Yeah.
Let's see what this man truly represents and some of his rhetoric's policies. As long as the Democrats in the White House, there's, you know, the black community has a voice in the White House.
Yep. No, I would,
and has an ear in the White House.
I wouldn't argue that.
They're not going to solve every problem, however.
I wouldn't argue that. I mean, we can be heard. The question is whether or not they do anything once they hear you. But we get an audience. We get an audience with the White House to make our case. Then the question is, again, what do they do? Let me ask you. I got 2 minutes left. Let me ask you right quick. What most scares you about Donald Trump? Again, you are the former Secretary of Homeland Security.
Yes.
With regard to that issue, what most scares you about what you keep hearing coming out of Donald Trump's mouth?
What most scares me, of course, is the rhetoric, the fascist rhetoric, frankly. And in a second Trump presidency, you will not have a Jim Mattis or a John Kelly or a Rex Tillerson, you know, responsible individuals who serve because they want to serve their country, because Donald Trump will not want to hire those people and they will not want to work for him. It's going to be Stephen Miller times 10. And that really, really frightens me, populating his administration if he's elected.
Yep. Let me close on this note. The question that Secretary Johnson asked me that I tried to respond to as best I could, given what I hear sitting in this chair and the conversations that I conduct every day and the conversations I have when I meet people on the streets about this presidential election cycle. That question is better put to one Cornel West, and I will put that question to him tomorrow when he's our lead guest. You probably know by now it's all in the news. Statement has gone forward. The announcement has gone forward, I should say. Cornel West will announce his vice presidential running mate on this program tomorrow. You all know he's running as an independent for president, and there are people who think that's a good idea and folks who think it's a horrible idea. People who think the timing is great, folks who think it's horrible timing to be running as an independent, but he will make his case tomorrow. But more importantly, or as importantly, he will do so with his vice presidential running mate, who he will announce on this program tomorrow in our first hour. His running mate will be with him. So we'll get a chance to talk to both of them once we discover who it is tomorrow in the first hour of this program. That said, for now, we thank Secretary Jay Johnson, former Secretary of Homeland Security, for this great conversation and for playing that great music on an amazing station in Newark that I love very dearly. Secretary Johnson, good to have you on. All the best to you, sir.
Always a pleasure to be on your show, Tavis. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward.